canine detection collaborative, a detection dog training trio with Stacey Barnett.
Hi.
Robin Grubel.
Hey there.
And Crystal Wing.
What's up?
With humor and a big dose of theory, our trio talks practical training advice and features interviews with top trainers and scientists.
It's Canine Detection Collaborative!
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Canine Detection Collaborative. I'm Robin Grubel, and I am going to spin us up and right into the second part of the interview that Crystal Wing and I did with Jens Frank. We are very excited about this particular episode where he shared some thoughts with us on how the proficiency you have going on in your training records might actually show a little bit of a lack of imagination on our part and how we aren't pushing our dogs hard enough. He also gave us the reasons behind the brand new Progression Plans app that they have out, which you can find in the show notes. And we talk about a couple of other things. So thank you all for joining us this week. Enjoy. This has got me, you know, thinking about all of the things that, you know, we're asking our dogs to do. And one of the things that I was super interested in is the app that you started to develop with all of the progression plans. And, you know, I was out there looking at it the other day, and like the functional sit has multitudes of steps.
yes.
Right. Which we don't think about. And we talk a lot about lumping in this show, that we have the tendency to lump all of this, the behaviors together, or we lump too many criterias together and we shift them and the dogs then fail. And so when did you guys really start putting together the progression plans that have now evolved into what we see on the app, and kind of what was that? And we'll include a link to the app in the show notes, but give us kind of that, how you started putting those together and how many spreadsheets you have and all of those things.
if I say how many spreadsheets we have, you would think that we are crazy. So I will not do that because there are so many. But I would say, first, I would just like to say that progression plans are really not something that we have come up with. It's just a list of sub-goals. So you set an end goal that is specific and measurable, and then you cut it down into sub-goals. And I would say that's the normal way to do it for training of humans in all sorts of disciplines, whether it's firefighters or shooting in the military or whatever. You have an end goal, and then you cut it up into smaller sub-goals that you should reach. And this is just doing the same for dogs. And I don't know, I don't remember when we started to do that. I think it was just out of necessity, because when we have the responsibility, which we have had for more than 20 years for different government dog programs and the dog handlers in them, to make sure they are developing and being able to meet the criteria of the certification every year. The variation in how dogs respond and the variation in the tasks that the dog teams meet is so huge. So when we just tell the dog handler that you should do exactly this way to teach your dog this, we often fall short, because then they do that and it works. But one day later, they are home, and then they are to take the next step. And then we or another instructor is not there. And then they have many times no idea how to do it. So then they are faced with trial and error. So we just started to do it as a way of helping the dog handlers to bridge the gaps when they don't have instructors there 24 hours a day. By just providing the sub-goals, we can then give them a path of which behaviors or skills are better to teach in the beginning. And by making the sub-goal specific, we can also regulate the level of arousal in these needed to accomplish the different steps. And we can also make sure that they are not using luring more than in the very, very first steps of training a certain behavior, because often it becomes a habit for the human and then it's hard to get rid of. So all these small things we can actually control a bit by having control of the order in which the different behaviors are taught in the sub-goals. But exactly how and exactly with what reinforcer, we don't really mess with that, because that will vary a lot between different dog individuals and humans. So the progression plan just tells you what the dog should be able to do, and we try to make the difference in difficulty as small as possible between the steps. So once you have reached step 20, it should be easy to reach the next step and then the next step.
I feel like without your progression plans, it's kind of like giving a trainer a loaf of bread and giving you a loaf of bread and saying, how many pieces? And they're going to cut it into like 4 pieces, the whole loaf. And you're going to cut it into like 50 pieces.
That was a very good illustration.
Yes.
I will steal that.
That's just a visual I always have where I'm like, if I give it to this new trainer, they're going to be like, oh, this is good about here and about there. And it's not even evenly spaced. And yours are like, yes, precisely measured, evenly spaced. Like, here is how we're going to have success.
Yes. So I find that the big thing with the progression plans is, one, it makes you set a specific and measurable end goal, because if you don't have that, you cannot really make sub-goals. And if you're not able to make a specific and measurable end goal, you will have to use mine or someone else's and the progression plan that comes with that. It will still be better to borrow someone else's end goal than to not have any at all. And if you're new in the dog training field, like most police or military dog handlers, they don't have the possibility to decide what is a realistic end goal, because they have not trained many dogs before. So it would be unfair to force them to decide that. Yeah, I think there are so many benefits. Maybe the largest one is that it allows you to evaluate the effects of your training continuously, not once or twice a year when you have your certification, but all the time, almost after each training session, you get to know if you have had progress or regressed or is just standing still. And then you need to change something. But if you fail your annual certification, you just know that something I did during the last 12 months wasn't perfect. But exactly what is very hard to identify. So I think that's the biggest advantage. And maybe another is, let's say I am driving and I need to stop and just let the dogs out to pee. So then I have a 5 or 10 minute chance to do training. And what most typically happens then is that you train on something that the dog already knows how to do. But if you have a progression plan that someone else has done or that you have made yourself, then you can just look up and see what is the next step. So that way you will always have progression and push forward. And I find that really beneficial.
So with the progression plans, it's so nice because if you read the descriptions that go with the progression plans, you do things like tell the reader, reinforce placement of your reinforcer is really important. And one particular progression plan where you list that like five times. And yeah. So what are some of the skills or knowledge that would, if you had handlers that were coming to you and getting dogs or you're working with, what are those things that you really would like people to know and understand?
Or do you mean like characteristics of that trainer? Like what do you look for in those trainers to make them successful?
And either one, or, you know, what is that thing? Because one of the things we talked about when you were here in Iowa is the whole concept of a dutiful trainer. But you also need somebody more than, you know, we can talk about what a dutiful trainer is, but then we really also need somebody a little bit, few other things besides always showing up.
Yes. So if I start very basic, and then I will try to rapidly move up to maybe more interesting stuff. But I really think that there is no way around a proper understanding of the operant conditioning model. And it is boring because that is also 100 years old. It's nothing new and fancy. And it doesn't describe the whole universe in a holistic model. But it is a model that when used, you can actually make your training more effective. So one thing is to have a theoretic knowledge about punishment and reinforcement. And in theory, the definition of a punishment is something that increases the frequency of behavior, and the definition of a punishment is something that decreases the frequency of behavior. So that is good. But what I find is that when we bring out the dogs, everyone, including me, reinforce behaviors that we want to see less of, and we punish behaviors that we want to see more of. Not because we want to, but because...
I was like, Jens, why are you doing that? Stop it.
Yes.
There, we were helpful for you today. We helped you with your training.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Good. Glad to help.
But there are so many things to pay attention to. And so, for example, today I was training the search pattern with four of the dogs I have. So then I am completely focused on that, getting the dog to have the same expectation to find the target, the first centimeter of the search to the last centimeter. But then I may miss other things. So I could actually see that I started cheating a bit with my start signal. Not deliberately, but because I was so focused on the search pattern. And that's not really good, because when the dog then starts searching, makes a find, and I reinforce, I'm probably reinforcing the whole chain to some extent, and I'm not in control really of which parts of it that are more or less reinforced. And, well, we do these things all the time because most of us are human, and that's not a good excuse, but it's a reason for why we do it, at least.
It's a good explanation. It's not a,
yes.
Yes, it's an explanation, not an excuse. So I think if we just first and foremost get good at identifying that all behaviors that decrease in frequency, they have been punished, whether we want it or not. And sometimes a behavior decreases in frequency because we reward it with something that isn't actually a reward to the dog, like trying to reward behaviors with food that we previously have been rewarding with a bond, maybe a punishment to a dog that is used to being rewarded with a ball every time. So if we are able to just grasp the concept of the operant conditioning model, it will make our training much more effective. So from there, then all the way to then being a dutiful or disciplined trainer. So we don't just do what we feel comfortable doing. And in detection, that means that we have to push ourselves. So, for example, in the exercises I did today, my goal is that the dog finds 50% of the targets I have placed. Because if the dog finds 10 out of 10 targets when searching a building, then I have been hiding them too easy. If the dog finds 5 out of 10, well, then I know that I am somewhere at the limit of this dog's skills right now. So then I will continue there. And then over time, so maybe tomorrow, the dog will find 7 out of 10 targets, although I am starting to place them deeper and deeper into structures, boxes, and bags. Well, then I will hide them a little bit deeper or more difficult so that we get back to finding 5 out of 10 again. And for the handler, it's more satisfying maybe to find 10 out of 10. But for the dog's development, it is better if we are at the limit of what the dog can do right now and give the dog a chance to actually be reinforced for also picking up on these minute, very small odors and following them to indicate them. Because if we don't do that, the dog will never get better.
That was an interesting concept for. I don't think I had picked that nuance up in some of the training, is that you might place 10 hides in a room with the understanding that the dog will probably only find five. And is that part of what you do to measure reliability, or is that something that you use in order to determine efficiency of searching, or how hard, or the skill level that the dog has to be able to work out difficult problems?
So it's just part of the progression. And my goal is to always have it like that. So when the dog is 1 year old, I aim for that. When the dog is 5 years old, I aim for that. And when it's 8 years old, I aim for that in training. But hopefully the 10 targets when it's 8 years or 5 years old is much more difficult for the dog than the 10 targets when it's just 1 year. But if the dog is finding all targets, you either lack fantasy or you're too concerned to your own needs to reward the dog 10 times instead of 5, I would say.
Wow. You just made me so happy when you say you lack fantasy, because I'm always saying imagination is one of our best tools, because we just get so stuck and so rigid and we forget, like, we have to kind of tinker and play and just kind of work through it and kind of work through some of the problems. Like, I love the progression plans. And I know that we had a moment on the, I think it was the second day of the seminar. And I think Robin asked for ahas and oh crap moments. And my aha was, you know, I was like, well, Jens gave you permission to steal his progression plan. And you were like, oh crap. But it was so wonderful to say, like, that we learn from each other and we take what each of us have to bring. And then we adapt it and we kind of take it to our own place of what we need for our sport, and we cross train and all of these things, but we have to bring our imagination to it too. I mean, and the progression plans are beautiful and I love them. But I know that there's already been pieces and little things that I'm like, okay, I would do this a little differently. So I tried it and I'm like, yeah, that worked for me. But that's that imagination piece and that experience piece. And it's not to say that what I did was better by any means, because like I said, I'm already like fangirling Jens here. But for the way that I do things, it worked a little better with a little tweak. And so that imagination, mm-hmm. that fantasy piece, oh, thank you for saying that. It just makes me adore you even more.
Yes. And okay, so I just had a brain cramp. You're talking about 10 hides in an area. And so one of the questions then becomes, are you doing them so they're small enough so you don't have shopping, so the dog starts cataloging hides? Or have you put enough, what are the precursors to that so you do not create a dog who will go find every single hide and then go back and find a previous one without alerting? Did you understand that?
I don't know. You say when I try to answer, so you say if I understood it correctly. So if it could be, let's say it's a building that is 200 square meters big. So there will not be hides in every room, but in some rooms there may be two. So the hides are not really close to each other. It's just that what I'm after is that the dog should, and typically it's the deeper hides. So in the beginning of the training, the dog is used to the hide being very shallow, close to where the nose of the dog can be. And then we want to make them deeper and deeper. So the target is placed inside a box or maybe 20 centimeters behind books on a shelf. And then we put them in a small container and in a bag in a wardrobe. But we go there gradually. So if the dog can find 1 gram of heroin when it is presented 5 centimeters from where the dog can get its nose, that does not mean that the dog will indicate when you have put that gram of heroin inside a matchbox, inside a small handbag at the back of a wardrobe, because then the picture of the odor will be totally different.
Okay, that makes sense. Right. Yeah, so, yeah, that makes sense, because, you know, and I think that this is one of the things that people have the tendency to start thinking, oh my gosh, I'm looking at my basement living room. I should put 10 hides in my basement living room. That's probably not the correct answer. So it's talking about over a larger area, those sorts of things, but it's keeping track of hide placement and how hard it is for dogs to pick up odor and all of those things that you're actually trying to achieve.
Exactly. So if it's just a smaller room, there may not be 10 hides there. It may be 1 or 0. So I will try to rephrase it then, because maybe, so the dog, the rule of thumb that I use is that the dog should find 50% of the hides. So it doesn't have to find 50% this search, but over, let's say, the last days, it should have found approximately 50%. If we get close to 100%, it's too easy. Then we need to make it more difficult again. If the dog is just finding 10% of the targets, then I think we have been increasing the challenge too much, too quickly. So then we need to make it a little bit easier.
Wait! Oh, sorry. I thought I had muted. I was yelling at my dogs. Oh my God, I'm so hurt. Nico is barking at my Dutchie is barking at somebody. Okay, so.
Good
and
job.
I was trying really hard to be like, oh my gosh, I just had a brain cramp, because people feel like their dogs have to find everything. But Okay, so pick up on whatever.
In the end, it would be good if the dogs did, but operationally, they will never. I mean, any of us can hide something in a way that no dog in the world can ever find it. It's not that difficult. And the problem is that the people who want to hide things from dogs, they experiment all the time, and they are not stupid people. They may be evil, but they are not stupid. And so it's an arms race because they are really creative and motivated. So they make it more and more difficult for the dogs, and the dogs just need to adapt. And that means our training is what needs to adapt, because the dogs will not do it automatically.
We're going to let that one set a little bit, because I think that the whole conversation around setting up your training so that the dogs only find, you know, X percent is going to be really an interesting conversation, at least here in the States, because one of the things that we actually are asking people to track in training logs is proficiency. And, you know, a higher proficiency is always better. So that's what people, well, my dog's got it, you know, is 90% of the time finding everything. And so then if we really start talking, well, they're 90% at finding everything that you hide, so maybe you should be hiding stuff harder, is a very thought-provoking conversation.
Yeah, my interpretation, if you have a training log where the dog is finding 90% of the targets consistently, would be that it doesn't say anything about the skill level of the dog, but the imagination of the handler or trainer is extremely bad. They could probably use a glass of whiskey before planning their next training session.
I prefer margaritas. I have much better training after a margarita. Yes. So, yes. Wow. Okay.
So, Jens, I'm curious, what are your dreams? What do you wish could be happening right now in the dog world?
Yeah, I have several fun projects that I would like to do, but I have one really dream project, and it's not unique. It would just be very helpful. So there is something called conservation evidence, and it has nothing to do with dogs, but it is a scientific journal and a web page where they do systematic reviews, and all scientific studies that contain evidence for or against the effect of different interventions when it comes to conservation of wildlife or plants is then categorized in this very easy to access web page. So managers who then manage conservation all around the globe can, by clicking easy buttons with silhouettes, whether they are working with frogs or mammals. And if they click mammals, then they have to choose if it's, you know, what group of mammals it is. And when they have chosen, for example, wolves, they can then have a look at the evidence when it comes to the effect of different interventions in conserving wolves. And one of my PhD students some years ago asked why we don't have that when it comes to interventions for protecting livestock, dogs, and humans from attacks from large carnivores. And there is no good answer to that. Of course, we should have made that a long time ago. So then she did that, and that is called Evi Wild, and she's then working doing reviews, and you would be surprised to see. So for example, the last review we did in that field, we started off with 50,000 scientific articles, And after the different steps of screening, there is a procedure for how to do these things. We ended up with 21 studies ever done when it comes to the effect of interventions in order to reduce damages from large carnivores all around the globe on livestock. Managers that work with this, they will never read 50,000 scientific articles. Mm-mm. And they will not read 21 either, but they will read the summaries that we make of each article, and then a synopsis where we, based on the evidence, because there are always some studies showing that it works and some showing that it doesn't work. But if we have then 5 pointing in one direction and 2 pointing in the other direction, then we can make a conclusion based on that. And when it comes to dog training, billions of dollars are spent on this worldwide annually. And yeah, just a lot of resources goes into it. And many dogs do critically important tasks. But the science has not really developed a lot since the time of Skinner and Jerks and Dodson 100 years ago. There has been an immense amount of scientific papers published. But just like in all other fields, most of them are correlation studies. So it shows some kind of correlation where it is impossible to tell apart cause and effect. And it would be so fantastic to make this kind of web page and easy to access database when it comes to different training methods, training devices, general principles in the world of working dogs, because none of the people working hands-on with dogs have the time or motivation to go through all thousands of scientific papers that you find if you search the databases. And I wouldn't recommend them to do it either, because it would be a waste of time. Because there are so few studies that actually has something to say when it comes to evidence for or against the use of different interventions. So if we would compare it with the medical sciences, we are where they were in the 1950s. So then if a patient survived, it was because the doctor was so skilled at his work. And if the patient died, well, it was because it was beyond saving when it arrived at the hospital.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like that in the working dog world. We don't have any evidence for the effect of different treatments or interventions. But in the medical sciences, they have been taking that route, and it has had major impact on what they do and the effect of the treatments they use.
So what do you need to make this dream possible? Is it the people? Is it the money? Is it the interest?
So typically, this is what PhD students or postdocs are used for.
Okay.
Because they are very labor intensive to make. If you make an ordinary literature review, that just takes a couple of months at best. But then you choose the articles that fit your own opinion. So they don't provide much. So it has to be a proper systematic review where all existing evidence, whether it fits my view or not. Of course, if it shows that progression plans are not useful, we will not publish that part. But all other things, we need to just have a procedure where we clearly show the inclusion criteria for the studies. And there are specifics such for doing these kind of systematic reviews, where we just need to have a randomized study design with proper controls. And if we don't have that, we just have to face that the results will be of a lower quality and lower interest.
So we need to hook up our universities with your university and get the amount of people. And then can you make a whole institute for this? Come on, you got this.
Yeah. We don't need that. So we have, from the Everwild homepage, we have the setup. We can use it from the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences. We can do the database setup there. But what we, it would be enough with one PhD student or two postdocs to start this. Then it would be continuous work. But once you get the bulk done, there are so few papers coming every year that contain evidence. So it wouldn't be hard to add them. My guess would be that there are fewer than five every year. So you could set up a system like they have done with the conservation evidence, where people submit either their manuscript or, better, they publish it in another scientific paper, and then people just submit which studies they think actually have the design that allows you to draw any conclusion on the cause or effect from anything relating to working dogs. So it's not complicated to do this. I mean, there is already systems for how to do systematic reviews. It's just needed people to do it.
Right. So we'll figure out how. So we'll make a plea for people to, if you're interested in funding that, to reach out to Jens, or you can reach out to us through the Canine Detection Collaborative, and we'll see how we can maybe try and start getting that graduate student funded. Because I think that one of the things that I see a lot is, you know, we share a lot of studies. Canine Census shares a lot of studies, but actually defining how that affects the everyday practitioner sort of gets lost in the scientific verbiage.
So. Yes. And hopefully this will also create an incentive for scientists to do these kind of studies, because they are harder to do than the correlation studies. And they are more expensive. So you will publish fewer studies if you do studies like this. And today, to merit yourself, you need many studies in your CV. But if, apart from having many studies, what is nowadays also important is the number of citations that your studies get. That is also very much valued when you later on apply for positions. So even if you have fewer studies, but they receive a lot of citations, that may outweigh the number of publications you have. And if we create this database, then these few studies with this proper design will surface, and they will be widely used by practitioners and more widely cited. And in the long term, I hope that can create an incentive for more scientists to put in the extra effort and do these studies.
Okay. I want to go back to, because I just realized, I was like, we did a really good job on the rabbit hole of talking about the operant conditioning quadrangle. But what other skills do you want your trainers to have, or handlers?
If I then can go to something completely different, just
yes,
to add some variation to what I'm talking about, I would say, so many of the special forces operators have no or very limited skills or experiences from training dogs, or even interest in that. But still, in a 1 year period, they can reach oftentimes what a regular police or sports dog handler cannot do in 20 or 30 years. not always, but quite often. And I would say that the one most defining factor, or more most significant factor creating that, is what you were talking about before, Robin, the dutifulness. So they are very loyal to the end goal, and they are very disciplined, and they will follow a training plan leading to the end goal, and they will not really consider whether they feel more like doing bite work today or detection or obedience. They will just do what is needed and be very disciplined in the large scale, but also in the smaller scale. They will, if you ask them to put the dog on a variable reinforcement schedule, many times they will have less problems doing that compared to a person that is into the dog training business because of their interest from the start.
They love dogs, right?
And their love of dogs. And they, because they are already junkies when it comes to rewarding the dog. So they get the kick out of rewarding the dog, and they respond to that by trying to get as many kicks as possible every day. While a person that is not yet a junkie or an addict when it comes to rewarding the dog would just stay with the plan and try to get the dog performing as good as possible, which requires you not to reward your dog every time. So, in short, discipline. I think that's the most important trait in a dog trainer.
It's been really interesting because I have sat a lot and thought about that dutiful training in some of the talks that we had while you were here in Iowa. And Crystal and I had a very long discussion since she comes up here, and we have to very specifically carve out time for us to train, because otherwise we get busy chatting or we get sucked in and end up coaching students instead of training our own dogs. And so it's been really nice. We've actually started training every morning from 8 to noon. And then during a seminars, we're training from 7:30 to 9, but our requirement is that we set up problems that will benefit the students and pertain to the topic of the seminar at hand, and then the students are welcome to come and watch. They can't ask questions until we're done. And so one of the things that I've noticed is that we just came off a 3-day seminar, and I was still up outside ready to train at 8 a.m. today, which was really weird. And so that actually is something that the whole conversation we had about the dutiful trainer really, really made an impact on how I approach my own training. So I want to say thank you for that tidbit of knowledge.
My dogs that you shared. Yeah, the other tip that you shared was good for me was when people on the internet had said, you know, like habits are like 21 days or something, and you're like, no, it's 2 to 8 months. I was like, oh, thank you. That just felt like it let me off the hook a little. I'm like, I've been doing this 21 days, and this is not a habit. But why am I broken? Why is this still not working? And so that was something you had said too that was really impactful from not from this conversation, but from the seminar.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, there are some really nice studies, not only on human habits, and many of them depart from the 1908 Jerks and Dodson studies on optimal arousal levels, because they were actually related to creating habits. They show that it takes 2 to 8 months in general to create a new habit. But there is a way to shortcut it a bit, and that is to connect the new habit to an already existing habit. So if you have one habit you can connect a new habit to it, and then it will go a little bit faster. How much faster, I don't know.
But you already gave the example of the habit stacking where you said when you had to stop to let the dogs out to go potty. So right there, it shows how dutiful you are in your training, because that's an opportunity for you to train. Whereas I see a lot of people, when it's time to let their dogs go out to go potty, like on a road trip, that's what happens. They go potty and they go back in. And it's such a loss of valuable training time, especially you're in a new place, new smells, new environment. You know, what are the things you're working on? It's that when I'm filling up my tank, I took a little video and shared it, and people were like, whoa, I never thought to train my dog while I'm filling up my gas tank. Mm-hmm. Okay. Why not?
That imagination piece is really big.
Yeah. It is.
Yeah. Well, and it was, I've used this example. So I was appropriately with appropriate attribution, though I tell it comes from you, is the whole concept of asking a kid, like a 10-year-old kid, to lay a track for your dog. And if the dog can't find you, you will pay them $5. And I was like, because that amount of unpredictability that gets put into your training is fantastic. I've started using it with the detection dog handlers that I have. So they're like, I don't have anybody to hide. Hides. It's like, you have kids, right?
Yeah. Child labor is widely used.
Wait a minute, when you put it that way.
You buy them ice cream and they're fine. Yeah, exactly.
We crossed a line, friends.
I know, we did. We probably did. Jens, thank you so much. Is there any like burning other things that you would like our listeners to know, either about you, about the Scandinavian Working Dog Institute, about what you might have coming up that you want people to be aware of and to check out on your website or Facebook page?
No, not really. If I can wish one thing, it is that they start to set specific and measurable goals and then just cut them into sub-goals. So they start making their own progression plans.
So don't just rip big chunks of bread out of the loaf. Don't just rip the pieces out, but actually like use a knife that's proper for it and slice it down. Is that what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying.
Okay,
but also,
okay.
in order to be good at cutting the loaves of bread, I mean, everyone understands the concept of cutting slices of bread.
It's easier with a bread knife.
In order to be good at doing it, you need to practice it.
Yeah.
And when you have been cutting 100 bread loaves, you will be much better than when you did the first one. And there are really no shortcuts. It's not enough to just understand the concept. You need to start doing it in order to get better at it. And then you will lose your patience with it. And you will quit, and then you will start again. It's perfectly fine, but you just need to get started at some point. Otherwise, you're just procrastinating it, and then things will never work. So that would be my wish.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time today. And we greatly appreciate all of the inspiration that you give to us, all of us over here across the pond and our listeners probably across the world. So thank you so much. And everybody, check out our socials. All of the stuff that we talked about in these episodes will be in the show notes. Go Trey.
Canine Detection Collaborative.
We appreciate the time you spend with us. If you liked this episode, not only should you follow us so you don't miss the next one, but please also rate and review us in your favorite podcast app. For info on collaborating with us, go to caninedetectioncollaborative.com. That's K9detectioncollaborative.com, where you can find our socials and pick up our latest monthly freebie. Join us again to talk training in the next episode.